as the first phase of a plan to end the war in Gaza takes effect. So how much credit does Trump deserve for this deal? It's Morning Edition from NPR News. Trump called for the prosecution of three people he views as enemies. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. His chosen prosecutor in Virginia has now indicted two of them in 3 weeks. New York's attorney general is accused of bank fraud. Also, the White House says assaults against immigration agents are up more than 1,000% this year. Colorado Public Radio found no evidence to back that up. It's Friday, October 10th. On this day in 1973, Vice President Spiro Agnew resigned. He was accused of accepting bribes. He admitted to tax evasion. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. This year's Nobel Peace Prize has been awarded. The chair of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, Jørgen Vatnes Frydenes, announced the news.
The Norwegian Nobel Committee has decided to award the Nobel Peace Prize for 2025 to Maria Corina Machado. She is receiving the Nobel Peace Prize for her tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela and for her struggle to achieve a just and peaceful transition from dictatorship to democracy.
Machado is a 58-year-old industrial engineer. She is living and hiding in Venezuela. She was blocked last year by Venezuelan courts from running for president against current leader Nicolas Maduro. Maduro claimed a landslide victory last year in his re-election campaign. That was a vote that election observers rejected as neither free nor fair. Today is supposed to mark the start of the first phase of a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. It is based on a plan proposed by President Trump. It calls for Hamas to release all hostages, living and dead, and for Israel to free hundreds of Palestinian prisoners and detainees. Israel is also supposed to pull troops back from zones in Gaza. But NPR's Greg Myrie says the timeline for that is unclear.
Israel has agreed to pull back in phases. It will initially move out of places like Gaza City and other Palestinian population centers. Now, they're eventually supposed to retreat to a buffer zone along the Gaza border, but still on the Gaza side of the border. Hamas had always demanded a full withdrawal of Israeli troops, but they just didn't have the leverage in these negotiations. With Israeli troops in Gaza, it wouldn't take much to restart hostilities.
NPR's Greg Myrie reporting. A federal judge in Chicago has temporarily blocked the National Guard from being deployed in Illinois. NPR's Sergio Martinez Beltran has more.
Federal Judge April Perry says deploying National Guard troops in Illinois would only add fuel to the fire. Under her ruling, the National Guard of the U.S. cannot be deployed within the state. The block will be in effect for 14 days. An appeal by the Trump administration is almost guaranteed. The Trump administration has said the National Guard is needed to protect an immigration processing facility outside of Chicago and protect ICE agents as they conduct arrests. Trump has said Chicago is a war zone, but protests have mostly been peaceful. And Judge Perry says the narrative of events presented by the Department of Homeland Security is, quote, simply unreliable. Sergio Martinez Beltran, NPR News, Chicago.
Separately, a federal appeals court is weighing whether Trump can deploy National Guard troops on the streets of Portland, Oregon. This is NPR. President Trump will go for a physical checkup today at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center. The White House says the president is in good health. Pope Leo is highlighting the plight of the world's poor. A new Vatican document says the world and the church must pay more attention to them. NPR's Jason DeRose has more.
The document called I Have Loved You says that the message of Christ was to care for the poor. Pope Leo says the issue of economic disparity is acute, with the rich accumulating more and more wealth and the poor becoming more and more destitute. He calls on Christians not only to engage in acts of charity to alleviate suffering, but also to work against systems, which he calls sinful, that perpetuate poverty. And Pope Leo highlights the plight of migrants, as well as his own time working in Latin America, where Catholic leaders have long taught that the church must prioritize the rights and needs of the poor and the powerless. Jason DeRose, NPR News.
Weather forecasters are watching storms in two different parts of the U.S. The remnants of Tropical Storm Priscilla, now swirling in the Pacific Ocean, are expected to storm across Mexico over the weekend. This could move into the U.S. Southwest, pouring very heavy rain on desert regions that are not used to getting this much precipitation. Separately, another storm system is off the U.S. East Coast. The National Weather Service says the potential nor'easter will bring flooding, heavy rain, and gusty winds to the region throughout early next week. There are also dangers from heavy surf and life-threatening rip currents on the coast. You're listening to NPR.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 seconds.
Fall 1962, Betty Pack had a killer pain in her jaw. Still, she took time to pore over an article in the London Sunday Times. It sketched the true story of a socialite born in Minneapolis who'd been recruited on the eve of World War II to spy for the British Secret Service. Pack looked at the byline. She knew him. So taking up pen, she wrote a letter to H. Montgomery Hyde, recollecting the sweltering summer day back in 1941 when the two of them had initially met. Cynthia was the name of the socialite spy he'd written about, and what both of them knew was that Pack had been that spy. Hyde had also been a spy, but now he was scraping by making a living as a journalist. After that article and an exchange of letters, retired agents reunited for old time's sake and to conduct a series of interviews about Pack's life as a spy. This would become the biography, Cynthia, the story of the spy who changed the course of the war. Published by Hyde in 1965, 2 years after Betty Pack died from the cancer in her jaw.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And I'm A. Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The ceasefire in Gaza has begun. At noon local time, the Israeli military said it had pulled back from its positions deep inside the enclave.
This is the first phase of a plan put forward by President Trump and includes the exchange of Israeli hostages held by Hamas for Palestinians detained and imprisoned by Israel. Trump says he'll travel to the Middle East this weekend, but senior White House officials are advising that the deal is still fragile, and there are still parts of the plan that could go wrong.
NPR White House correspondent Deepa Shivaram joins us now. A lot of elements of this plan are still being sorted through. What are officials worried about?
Well, good morning, guys. Senior White House officials said yesterday on a call with reporters that there's still a lot of involvement and work to do to make sure there aren't misunderstandings between the two sides. They said this is a very delicate time. There's a short window here where Israeli troops retreat from parts of Gaza. The hostage release and the Palestinian prisoner release is supposed to take place. But the even bigger question is what happens next and what is the U.S. involvement going to look like? And like you mentioned, these officials last night said that the U.S. is sending about 200 troops to the region. They're going to be part of what's called an ISF, or an International Stabilization Force, which was created in part of Trump's peace plan. So their role is oversight to make sure that there aren't any violations of the agreement, according to White House officials. And they'll be working alongside with Egyptian forces, as well as forces from Qatar and Turkey and the UAE, and keeping those governments as well as the Israeli government informed about what they're seeing.
Will any of those U.S. troops go to Gaza?
White House officials said the U.S. forces are not intended to go into Gaza, but they weren't at this point specific about where troops would be stationed. That plan is still being developed.
Okay, so in the meantime, what has the president been saying about the agreement?
Well, the president's been pretty elated about all of this. He held a cabinet meeting yesterday and talked at length about getting this deal done and repeatedly said that this deal meant peace in the region.
It's amazing. I've never seen anything quite like it. I've been very much involved. I've never seen anything quite like it. But it's really peace in the Middle East.
And speaking of Trump's involvement, I mean, White House officials said he was involved at many points in the negotiations, that he would even call in himself during the talks to talk with some of the interlocutors. I will say, though, that there are some elements of this agreement that are still a little bit unclear. Yesterday, for example, a reporter asked what would happen if Hamas didn't return all the hostages. Right now, there are believed to be 48 hostages and 20 are believed to be alive. Trump said some of the bodies would be hard to find, but, quote, we're going to do the best we can. And he didn't really get into what the consequences of what might happen. The other thing that Trump is still a little bit unclear on is how Gaza will be rebuilt. He said that wealthy Arab nations would be part of the rebuilding process, but White House officials said yesterday that no financial commitments have been made yet from those nations.
Okay, we mentioned earlier that the president plans to travel to the region. What do we know about those plans?
Yeah, so Trump said that he's trying to leave on Sunday to travel to the region. It's not exactly clear yet where he's going, but he said he'd most likely be in Egypt, where those negotiations are taking place. And he was also invited by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to address Israel's parliament, the Knesset. And Trump said he hopes to be there when the hostages are released, which is potentially Monday or Tuesday. So still firming up some of the details of where and when this trip takes place. But the presence of President Trump on the ground speaks to how much of a heavy hand he's had in this process.
All right, that's NPR's Deepa Shivaram. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
For more on President Trump's role in brokering the deal, we're joined by Gershon Baskin. He's a veteran hostage negotiator, Israeli peace activist, and was involved in back-channel discussions over this deal. Good morning, and thank you for being on the program.
Good morning.
So first, could you just briefly describe what role you played in or access you had to these negotiations?
Well, for about 2 months now, I've been in regular communication with Steve Witkoff, the presidential envoy to the Middle East and his number one confidant. And from that point, I was communicating with him, mostly a one-way communication, on the importance of the U.S. understanding that the only way that the war in Gaza would end is if President Trump decides that it has to end, because Prime Minister Netanyahu had no interest in ending the war whatsoever. He was willing to continue it forever because it keeps him in power. At one point, about 2 months ago, it became a two-way communication, I think slowly building up to a level of trust and understanding the role that I could play, having 18 years of experience of being in contact with leaders within Hamas. It became much more intense as the time went on. A month ago, we were in daily contact, telephone and WhatsApp messages, and I was not acting as a U.S. Employee. I have no relationship with the U.S. government, but I was acting as someone who could communicate. My belief since Trump entered the White House was that there was no Israeli interlocutor for a peace deal. We didn't have to negotiate with the Israelis. We only had to negotiate with the Americans and Hamas. It was difficult for me, and my challenge with Hamas was to convince them. Every time they said, Israel won't accept this, Israel won't accept that, I kept telling Hamas, Israel won't accept anything. You have to imagine that you're sitting in a room across the table from Donald Trump, not from Netanyahu. The person you need to convince is Trump. Trump will impose a deal on Israel when the time is right, when he believes that you are serious about ending this war, returning the hostages, no longer controlling Gaza. When the Americans are convinced that that's the reality, then Trump will impose a deal on Israel. At the end of the day, that's in fact what happened.
So how much credit do President Trump and Steve Witkoff then deserve for this deal?
100%. There's no question about it. Without Trump, this would not have happened. And it was a challenge because Trump and Witkoff held the Israeli position that Hamas can be brought to its knees, that Hamas would surrender. One of the difficult discussions I had repeatedly with Witkoff was my position, my understanding that Hamas will never surrender, certainly not to Israel. Hamas would be willing to fight to the very last Gazan, but they will never surrender to Israel. And until the Americans accepted that as the reality, there was no chance that Trump would impose an end to the war on Netanyahu. I'm not sure that they believe that Hamas could not be brought to its knees, but in the end of the day, as a result of the Israeli assassination attempt in Doha, it decided that the war had to end. It was getting too dangerous for the American relations with their Arab partners in the region, which are honestly, in terms of Trump's point of view, much more valuable than his relationship with Israel.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, Trump has sympathy for Netanyahu and for Israel, but he's a businessman. Steve Witkoff, if you look at him, he's an American Jew from New York involved in real estate, but his investments, his business investments, were in Qatar and in the UAE, not in Israel. This is a unique person working for a U.S. president in charge of the Middle East file whose major focus was the Arab Gulf and not Israel.
It sounds like what you're saying is that when Prime Minister Netanyahu made the decision to bomb Qatar and the negotiators, he went a step too far and in some ways brought about this deal.
I think that's exactly what happened. Part of the problem is that I don't think you can find a person in the Middle East, maybe in the entire world, who doesn't believe that Israel did it without a green light from Washington. The problem is that Israel failed. They didn't succeed. If they had succeeded in killing the Hamas leadership, the American administration, Trump, might have said this was a great move and we got rid of really bad people. We know the way that Trump speaks, but the fact that it failed put Trump in a very difficult position, and he immediately had to dissociate himself and the United States from it, saying they didn't authorize it, they didn't greenlight it, they warned the Qataris that it was coming, they didn't have enough time, etc.
And you were passing those messages to Hamas, right?
Oh, certainly. When Witkoff sent me the message, he even said, don't distribute this, but you can tell Hamas that we had nothing to do with it. We didn't greenlight it, and we didn't approve it, and we condemned it. And then Trump put it on Truth Social that he condemned it. And I know that Witkoff wrote a lot of the messages that Trump put on Truth Social about the deal. Or that's what I believe, at least, that Witkoff was the author of them. Trump put it out. It came out in his name. One of the reasons for the success of Witkoff is because everyone knows that when Witkoff speaks, he's speaking for President Trump.
You've said that Hamas agreed to the same terms of this agreement that just was agreed to more than a year ago. And that means tens of thousands of lives ago. Why wasn't a deal reached then? I mean, what is different about what President Trump did and what President Biden did?
I think there are two factors. One is that Biden's relationship with Israel was problematic from the Israeli side. Let's face it, Benjamin Netanyahu and Ron Dermer, his main ally in the Israeli government, are Republicans. They support the American Republican Party, not the Democratic Party. They were hostile to Barack Obama. They were hostile to Joe Biden. And they were very supportive of Donald Trump. So that was one thing. Biden never had the leverage over Netanyahu that Trump has. I couldn't get Biden's people to look at the deal that I negotiated with Hamas in September 2024, the three-week deal, that the war would end within 3 weeks, they would return all the hostages, they would no longer govern Gaza. It got to the desk of Biden, but Brett McGurk, who was in charge of the negotiations, wouldn't even look at it. The Qataris invited me to Doha. They had already seen the three-week deal, but they told me they couldn't do anything with it if the Americans didn't pick it up. And I sat with two members of Biden's team in Tel Aviv, and they were so frustrated that we couldn't get the Biden people to move on the possibility of ending the war within 3 weeks. Trump is a different story. Netanyahu is a Republican, and Trump has the ability to tell Netanyahu what to do, and Netanyahu cannot say no to Trump.
When you say he's a Republican, you mean he's a supporter of President Trump? Or,
yeah, that's what I mean. He's clearly his ideology, his life philosophy, his worldview is much more aligned with the Trump Republican Party than with the Democratic Party in the United States.
That's longtime Israeli hostage negotiator and peace activist Gershon Baskin, who is involved in back-channeling here in this deal. Thank you so much for your time.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Marines and there in the Marines.
This is Drew Miller from Boiled and Lead urging you to support KAXE and KBXE. Community radio is a lifeline for culture, and these days it's under threat. If you enjoy it, you need to help pay for it because nobody else is going to do it except for you. Please support KAXE and the Summer Pledge Drive.
Make a donation now by visiting our website, kaxe.org, and clicking the word donate, or text donate to 218-326-1234.
Climbing up that old gallows ladder, cried out so gaily for his high white cap and feather. I've always been a lively lad, never murdered.
NPR comes from this station and from Easy Cater, a business tool for food designed to help organizations order food for meetings and events from restaurants nationwide, set up employee lunch programs, and manage food spend at easycater.com. From Workday, an AI platform to manage HR, finance, and agents that aims to free business leaders from the mundane so they can focus on more meaningful work. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Amy Martinez. The White House says assaults on Immigration and Customs Enforcement officers are up more than 1,000% this year. And they're using that big alleged increase to justify deploying troops to American cities and to investigate what it calls domestic terrorist organizations. But there is no publicly available evidence to back up that claim. That's the findings of an analysis from Colorado Public Radio. Allison Sherry is a reporter there, joins us now from Denver. Allison, so what are the findings?
Yeah, you know, we found that the assaults on federal officers have grown recently, but nowhere near 1,000%. Our analysis shows it's around 25%. And it's probably a little more now as ICE embarks on aggressive enforcement actions in Chicago and other places, and those actions are sparking blowback in the community.
So tell us about your investigation. How did you conclude that the number of assaults is much lower than the White House is claiming?
I mean, at first we asked, you know, we asked the Department of Homeland Security for data that backed that claim, and they declined to provide any context or numbers they're keeping. Both we and NPR have repeatedly asked for this data. So then we went to federal court filings to arrive at this number. We looked at the number of charges filed specifically for assault on a federal officer in courts across the country and looked at 5 years worth of records. And we did find that assaults on ICE officers have gone up for sure in this administration, again, around 25%. But that's nowhere near the administration's claim of a 1,000% increase. And the administration has also insisted that it will aggressively prosecute any assaults on ICE officers. So that means that a 1,000% increase would eventually be reflected in court filings, but we're not seeing it.
ICE, though, they have been a lot more active this year, operations in Los Angeles and also other cities, which means a lot more opportunities for them to get into scuffles or be assaulted. So did you see any evidence of that?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we did find that some of the most recent increase is reflected in Los Angeles, where there were big deployments and immigration enforcement actions by ICE agents. And I assume we'll see more assaults on officers in Chicago, for example, and other places as well. And I should just note that assaults on a federal officer can take a while to be investigated and show up as charges. So there will be a lag time in the data, but we're just not seeing these indications that it's anywhere near what they've been claiming.
Yeah, but hasn't the administration been making these claims about huge increases and assaults on officers for months now?
Yeah, since June. And that's what started us down this road. You know, over the summer between June and August, the increase in assaults they were claiming jumped from 400% to 1,000%. And this is relevant for a number of reasons. You know, credibility is one. But notably right now, they're using this alleged huge increase in assaults to justify sending National Guard troops to places like Chicago to keep ICE agents safe, even though local officials say there's no crisis of violence.
How has the Trump administration responded to your fact-checking their claims?
They haven't been in touch. We've asked repeatedly for the data backing up the claims. They did send us a bunch of old press releases about attacks on officers, but again, nothing they've sent has added up to 1,000%.
All right, Allison Sherry with Colorado Public Radio. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Time now for StoryCorps. Grant Brenner and Ari Gildinger's met in elementary school in New Jersey in the 1970s. They had a lot in common, except that Brenner lost his mother to cancer when he was very young.
I was a shy little kid. I didn't want to separate from my mother, and she took me everywhere. I would go to restaurants with her or shopping at Saks Fifth Avenue. But I don't really remember my mother very well. I have vague flashes of memories, like her smoking a cigarette. The most vivid memory I have is the last time I saw her.
When was that?
It was a morning, and she had to go to the hospital. I remember her standing in the hallway. My father and one of my brothers were holding her up because she couldn't support her own weight, and her chemo wig was kind of askew. She insisted on wearing her favorite fur coat. She did not want to go to the hospital. I think she must have known this was it for her. I was 9, and after my mother died, my father was like, "Your mom wrote letters for all of you, and here's yours. I'll read it to you if you want me to."
Yeah.
Okay. "Dear Grant, you are so little, I don't know quite what to say to you. I wanted to have you with all my heart. My greatest joy in life would be to stay with you. We cannot always have what we want, so we must be content with what we have. I give you loves, hugs, and kisses for all the tomorrows. Have a good life. Love, Mother." It's very sad. I wish it were a letter, but it's more of a note. But in some ways, I think that note also carried me through.
When she died, I remember my mom saying it at the dinner table, but I couldn't really understand the kind of pain you were going through.
You stuck with me, though.
We would watch Doctor Who.
Play Dungeons and Dragons. There were times where I really wished that I were in a different world.
And my parents, they really enjoyed having you around. They joked that you were like my brother.
Your mom was the closest thing I ever had to a second mom.
She died a year and a half ago, and I really felt you understood.
I didn't go to my mother's funeral. I really regret that. And I cried more at your mother's funeral than I've ever cried in my whole life.
My mom really loved you, and she wanted to make sure you were okay.
Yeah, she did.
Grant Brenner and Ari Gildinger's Remembering Their Mothers, Judith Horowitz and Esther Gildinger's. Their recording is archived at the Library of Congress.
Major support for StoryCorps comes from Dignity Memorial. For many families, remembering loved ones means honoring the details that made them unique. Dignity Memorial is dedicated to compassion in every detail of a life celebration. DignityMemorial.com. And from Subaru. Subaru has donated more than $70 million to support the adoption, rescue, transport, and health of over 700,000 animals. Learn more at Subaru.com/pets.
This is NPR News.
The debate over free speech and comedy is not just an American one. In Russia and France, satirical puppet shows that made fun of the powerful ended up off the air.
It's easy to cancel a show. The only thing needs a billionaire is time and money.
I'm Elsa Chang, a global look at the clampdown on comedy on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Good morning. It's 5:29. You can hear All Things Considered coming up this afternoon at 4 o'clock. It's here on KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. We've got a lot ahead for you today, including the sports page, what's for breakfast, and we'll be bringing you information about all the things going on in our region. Let's start off with what kind of weather you can expect for today and also into the weekend. It is looking like pretty mild for this time of year. We're expecting 58 to 62. A lot of wind, though. Breezy northwest winds 10 to 20. And tomorrow, Saturday's looking sunny with temperatures in the low to mid 60s. We've been talking a lot about funding and how public media is changing before our eyes. In the first year of operation, 1976, they'd already been trying to get us on the air for a couple of years. But that first year, there was no federal funding. They could not quite convince the government that people in a rural area would use or need public media. Ever since then, almost 50 years, we have been operating with federal funding. That helps us pay for our costs of things like electricity, keeping our buildings going, and all of that. This year, that promised money that was budgeted was rescinded, and that happened at the end of July of 2025. And then we came to you, and we thank you so much for helping us. As we go forward each year, 13% of our budget will no longer be there. Your donations, though, keep us going. Help us get to new sources of funding as well, because what people want to know, what foundations want to know, is are people really listening? It's a vote of confidence from you, and it keeps us on the air, to be honest. And it's a powerful reminder that first year we operated without federal funding that we can do it again, and we will, because we're people-powered and you're there for us. Thank you for your support. Text the word DONATE to 218-326-1234. Here's a perfect example of how KAXE is people-powered. It's about people who are curious about the world around them. Here's John Latimer.
On today's date, October 10th in the year 2000, my son Martin directed me to a spot where he had seen some snakes crawling into a hole in the ground. Turns out a tree had blown down and the excavation created by the stump left some holes in the soil that the snakes could exploit as a place of hibernation. So the snakes, and there were three of them, were crawling into these vacuums, vacancies left by the roots that had been torn loose from the tree. And those openings provided places where they could huddle together below the frost line and wait out the winter. They will do so by reducing their respiration and metabolism to nearly death levels. And once the earth warms up in the spring, they will emerge fit and healthy and ready to go back to work.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Workday. Workday is an AI platform for forward thinkers dedicated to transforming the way business leaders manage people, money, and agents today so they can transform tomorrow. Workday, moving business forever forward. And from the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel in Washington, D.C.
And Amy Martinez in Los Angeles, California. The Justice Department followed President Trump's public calls and brought charges against his top rivals.
Yeah, New York Attorney General Letitia James was indicted on bank fraud and false statement charges. This comes after the same office indicted former FBI Director James Comey. President Trump replaced the top federal prosecutor there with one of his former lawyers. And that's the person who secured this indictment.
NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas joins us now. Ryan, so what more can you tell us about the charges against James and the prosecutors who are bringing this case on?
Well, as Leila just mentioned, James faces two charges here, one count of bank fraud, one count of false statements to a financial institution. And the indictment alleges that James bought a house in 2020 in Norfolk, Virginia, but prosecutors say she falsely claimed it as a second residence to get better terms on her mortgage. And the indictment says with those more favorable terms, she would have saved a total of almost $19,000 over the life of the loan.
Okay. Now, the indictment was handed up by a grand jury in the Eastern District of Virginia. So that's the same place where the former FBI Director James Comey was indicted just a few weeks ago.
That's right. And there's been a huge amount of turmoil in that U.S. Attorney's office there in the past few weeks because of the Comey case and this case against James. The career DOJ attorney who had been the top prosecutor there had basically concluded after lengthy investigations that the evidence in the separate cases against Comey and James was too weak to bring charges. The White House didn't like that. They pushed that prosecutor out. In his place, President Trump installed Lindsay Halligan, an insurance lawyer who had once served as Trump's personal attorney, but she has no prosecutorial experience. Days later, Halligan secured the indictment against Comey, and now a few weeks on, she presented the case yesterday against James to the grand jury. Now, these two indictments against Letitia James and James Comey came after President Trump publicly called on the Justice Department to prosecute them, and that has alarm bells ringing, that Trump is using the Justice Department, weaponizing it to target his perceived political enemies.
Now, nationwide, people might know who James Comey is, but maybe not Letitia James as much. So what is Trump's issue with Letitia James?
So when James campaigned to become New York's Attorney General, she vowed to investigate Trump. Once she was in office, she did exactly that. Ultimately, she sued Trump and his company for inflating the value of some of their assets. She won that case in court, a massive $450 million judgment, although that financial penalty was later tossed out on appeal. But Trump has repeatedly lashed out at her during the presidential campaign last year. For example, he said that she should be arrested and punished. And then in a social media post last month, Trump urged the Attorney General, Pam Bondi, to go after James and other political foes, saying that they were guilty and that justice must be served.
Has James said anything in response to all this?
She put out a video on social media. She called the indictment a continuation of Trump's weaponization of the justice system. She also said this.
These charges are baseless. And the president's own public statements make clear that his only goal is political retribution at any cost.
James said she's being targeted because she did her job as New York State Attorney General. She said she stands behind her office's investigation in the civil fraud suit against Trump. And she said she's not afraid and that she is going to continue to do her job.
All right, that's NPR Justice Correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thanks.
Thank you.
For more, we turn to Eli Honig. He's a former federal prosecutor and author of the new book, When You Come at the King, Inside DOJ's Pursuit of the President from Nixon to Trump. Good morning and thanks for being on the program.
Thanks for having me, Leila.
So how big of a victory is this for Donald Trump?
Well, I guess it depends entirely on how you define a victory. Mm-hmm. One defines victory as we got an indictment and we will get to march Letitia James into a courthouse and have her sit at the defendant's table. Then it's a victory. If you mark victory by upholding the standards of independence of the Justice Department, it is certainly not that. And if you define victory as ultimately obtaining a conviction, that remains to be seen.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I want to know how unusual it is for the president to openly call for the prosecution of his perceived political enemies, urge the Justice Department to do that. When a prosecutor doesn't do it, replace them with their own lawyer. I mean, how unprecedented is all this involvement?
Well, I think we tend to overuse that word unprecedented, mm-hmm. but I can affirm for you, this is truly unprecedented. My book, which you just alluded to, goes back every modern investigation back to Watergate. And we've never seen a president overtly, explicitly, publicly declare, I want these people by name. Letitia James is now the second person on that list who has been indicted, joining Jim Comey. I want these people charged. And it's overtly political. And that's the line that's crossed here. I mean, This case, sure, it's about whether Letitia James lied on her mortgage applications, but much bigger picture, it's about the powers of the presidency and the limitations on that power when it comes to the independence of the Justice Department.
You hear often from the White House, from Republicans, well, the Democrats started it. They came after us. I mean, Letitia James successfully went after Trump in court. What's the difference between what James' prosecution of Trump was and what Trump and the DOJ's now case against James is?
Well, there's some truth to that. The Democrats did start this. I mean, Letitia James did start this. She overtly, explicitly promised and fundraised throughout her 2018 campaign for attorney general, essentially, vote for me and I will nail Donald Trump for something. At times she said she'd indict him. It would be money laundering. It would be something with his real estate business. She did end up bringing a civil lawsuit against him, not a criminal prosecution. It was ultimately, I would say, not successful. I mean, she got a verdict from a judge and a massive fine attached to it, but a New York State appeals court threw out the entire fine. The end result of that is a $0 judgment. So I think it's a mixed verdict at most. That said, none of that justifies the president of the United States weaponizing his own Justice Department to seek retributive justice. I mean, I think we have to be clear here. Both of those things are true. Letitia James absolutely targeted Donald Trump in her campaign as attorney general. Donald Trump is absolutely targeting her now as payback. Neither of them is okay. And I would argue what the president is doing, because he is the president, is worse and more corrosive.
What are the dangers of breaking down the barriers between the Department of Justice and the White House? And are there ways to put the guardrails back?
It's a great question. There is nothing in the U.S. Constitution. There is no law passed by Congress that says DOJ must be or should be independent. Rather, that is the result of a decades and really centuries long tradition and understanding and best governmental practice. I was at DOJ half the time under a Republican president, half the time under Democratic president. It made no difference. That is the essence of what DOJ is and has been. And when we break that down, when a president says, this wall of independence, I'm just taking it down, that is incredibly dangerous, because no other entity within the federal government has the ability to deprive civilians of their liberty. Only DOJ has that. And when you politicize that and make it subject to the whims of the president or any other powerful person, we're going down a very dangerous path.
Ellie Honig is a former prosecutor, author, and CNN analyst. Ellie, thank you.
Thanks very much.
This is NPR News.
Debuting on October 16th, KEXE brings you a brand new podcast, Season Watch, exploring the seasonal wonders of life in northern Minnesota. Voices like Charlie Mitchell, John Latimer, and our listeners. Find it on most podcast platforms. Season Watch is a podcast for those who are curious about the changes in nature. It's 5:42. You're listening to Morning Edition from National Public Radio. We've got local news coming up for you at 7:01 with the Up North Report. You can check out stories, longer versions of these stories by our news team at our website. Right now, read about how hunger fears are growing in Minnesota as food shelves are overwhelmed. And also about the Crosby fire that has grown to 50 acres in remote Crosby Manitou State Park, and how the Minnesota Interagency Fire Center has been reporting and is working to contain this fire. Things like that are available, as well as Area Voices from Andrew Dezingle, teaching us about how the Heartland Symphony Orchestra is kicking off their fall season. Check it all out at KAXE.com. KAXE.org. We'd like to thank the business supporters of KAXE, and that includes Lake Country Journal, a local lifestyle magazine sharing stories about places to go, things to do, and people to know in Lake Country. More at lakecountryjournal.com. And programming is also made possible in part by Empty Bowls. They fight local hunger and build a stronger community with the Grand Rapids and Deer River Community Cafe. The event takes place Thursday, October 23rd at Timberlake Lodge from 11 to 2 and 4 to 7. Tickets include soup and a locally made ceramic bowl. More info on Facebook at Itasca Empty Bowls Project. More news is coming up next.
Station. And from Fisher Investments. As a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their clients' best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from the Cy Sims Foundation, since 1985, supporting advances in science, education, and the arts towards a fairer, more just, and civil society. More information is available at cysimsfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. Venezuela's opposition leader, Maria Corina Machado, won this year's Nobel Peace Prize earlier this morning. The Norwegian Nobel Committee said Machado's tireless work promoting democratic rights for the people of Venezuela is, quote, one of the most extraordinary examples of civilian courage in Latin America in recent times. NPR international correspondent Eleanor Beardsley is covering the announcement. So, Eleanor, tell us about Maria Corina Machado.
Well, A, she is a right-leaning democracy activist in Venezuela, the leader of the democratic forces fighting the authoritarian regime of Nicolás Maduro. And the committee called her a courageous defender of freedom who refused to stay silent and lives in hiding in her own country to fight for democracy. They described how she led her followers to count the votes at the polls in the 2024 presidential election before it could be stolen by Maduro. Here is the Nobel Committee chair, Jürgen Vatna Friedness, announcing the Peace Prize this morning.
Despite the risk of harassment, arrest, and torture, citizens across the country held watch over the polling stations. They made sure the final tallies were documented before the regime could destroy ballots and lie about the outcome.
So, what message do you think, Eleanor, the Nobel Committee is trying to send here?
Well, it's certainly sending a message about the whittling away of democratic norms and freedoms across the world. They said Venezuela was hardly the only place sliding into autocracy and depression. Here again is Jürgen Vatna Friedness.
However, we live in a world where democracy is in retreat, where more and more authoritarian regimes are challenging norms and resorting to violence. The Venezuelan regime's rigid hold on power and its repression of its population are not unique.
Eleanor, it seemed that President Trump has had the Nobel Peace Prize on his mind for at least a little bit. And just this week, the Gaza peace plan that he brokered is going into effect. Do you think the people that wanted him to win will be disappointed?
Well, maybe a little, but they won't be displeased because Machado is a pick that will appeal to Trump supporters and democracy advocates. She might even be seen as controversial. She's a big supporter of President Trump and praises the administration frequently. Here she is on Fox News reacting to when the Trump administration offered a $50 million award for the arrest of Nicolás Maduro.
We are very grateful to President Trump for his decisive action towards freedom in Venezuela and the region. The Trump administration knows very well that Maduro is the head of a terrorist criminal organization.
Help. So we haven't heard any reactions yet from Maduro, or anybody else in the region, but I think this pick of the Nobel Committee this year is going to generate a very lively reaction and discussion in the region and beyond. When they first spoke about a woman who is fighting for freedom, many people may have thought of it was Alexei Navalny's wife, Yulia Navalnaya. Came up and it was a big surprise to everyone.
All right. That's NPR's Eleanor Beardsley. Thanks for all the information.
You're welcome.
Yeah. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Lee Martinez.
And I'm Leila Faldin.
You should give as you are able, because the need is immediate.
Longtime KAXE contributor and Minnesota Star Tribune columnist Aaron Brown. We talked about recent cuts to public media.
It's the people here who make it go. If you want a nice, independent, completely northern Minnesota media source that isn't beholden to anybody else, you have to be willing to put in a little bit of money. This is the time, this is the moment when we have to make decisions about what really is important to our community and to ourselves.
I'm Jennifer Barr. Give right now at KAXE.org. Thank you for your support.
What's a U.S. economy to do if foreign tourists feel unloved?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by the Financial Times. Global news, geopolitics, and market data all in one place. Source FT. There's more at FT.com.
I'm David Brancaccio. The travel and tourism industry contributes $2.9 trillion to the U.S. economy. More even than the size of the automotive industry, but can travel and tourism thrive at a time the U.S. is working to overhaul border and trade policy? I'm just back from what had been a red-hot spot for tourism in America, Las Vegas, and found an economy that's being dealt some tough hands. Dinner time on a weeknight. There are cars at the lights at the corner of all corners, Las Vegas Boulevard and Flamingo Road. But traffic's a breeze. Next month, a big Formula One event should bring a surge of racing fans. And since it's Vegas, you'll always find some hubbub. Here's Ashley from Toledo.
I'm a big TikTok person, so everything says it's going to be dead here. It's a dying city, and we're like, it's not that dead.
So not Deadsville, but using the August figures, the number of visitors is down 6.7% from a year earlier. And under the video canopy covering Fremont Street downtown, foot traffic is also sparse. Leah and Klaas are part of a Dutch and Belgian tour group out sipping refreshment. And they came, but
some people of our group, they skipped the trip because the situation here in the U.S.
You know, the situation, hardened borders and a global trade war, higher fees to come into the U.S. and other restrictions for people without U.S. passports. For instance, the early fall has typically been prime time for people from Mexico and Point South to come, but this time many Latin-themed events got canceled. As for that part of North America President Trump talks of adding to the United States,
Canada's down, probably the most significant of anyone, by some measures down 30% over where they were a year or two ago. But Canadians make up about 3 to 3.5% of all the visitors that come to Las Vegas. So, you know, at the end of the day, it's an impact.
Jeremy Aguero of Applied Analysis, a Las Vegas-based research and consulting firm. Among the down spots, what people here call the three C's, visitors from Canada. China, with its property market mess hitting disposable incomes there, and one more C, not a country, but the adjacent state.
People from California. And with all these raids and deportation and all these anti-immigrant message that is going on right now. People, they don't feel good coming in here. They're fearful.
Deanna Vias is president of the Culinary Workers Union, Las Vegas Local 226.
We're seeing layoffs. We're seeing restaurant closures. People are nervous just to go to the grocery store. Yeah. The people are nervous just to go to church. Even if you are documented people in this country, because you never know what's going to happen, is your profile. When we heard people saying that they're going to deport criminals, we're okay about that. Our members are not okay to deporting people, working people, just because the way they look.
Another shift engineered in Washington that's percolating into every regional economy, this one included, are new import taxes, the tariffs. Juani Romero opened 7 high-design cafes in Las Vegas called Mothership Coffee Roasters.
Oh my goodness, the majority of coffee is from Brazil. And it's like, just because the president doesn't like the way the Brazilian president is talking to him, we're going to impose a 50% tariff and literally change everything overnight.
Mothership has deals with women-owned suppliers of raw beans in Brazil, relationships not easily switched to lower tariff countries.
The most important thing is we care from beginning to end, and that's what makes coffee really cool and relevant. But with these things going on, a lot of roasters aren't able to care as much because prices are going up. They can't afford to care and charge their customer. You can't charge your customer $40 for a bag of coffee. That's insane.
Again, data man Jeremy Aguero.
David, any of these things, if it was just one of them, you and I wouldn't be even talking. But the combination of conflict in Washington, D.C., conflict around the world, the fact that consumers are feeling uncertain, all of that is converging today into this very difficult circumstance that we see ourselves in. Do I think it's permanent, structurally unsound? No, I do not.
We also talked to a longtime waiter at one of the big casino hotels about how he reads the economy. The Marketplace Morning Podcast will have that later this morning. Markets S&P futures are steady, I would say, ahead of an October reading on U.S. consumer sentiment. Dominion Voting Systems of Canada has been purchased by a Missouri-based firm that sells a popular election software program. The purchase price not disclosed yet. The buyer of Dominion will be called Liberty Vote and is owned by Scott Leyendecker, a tech CEO with multiple connections to Republican officials. President Trump had made baseless claims against Dominion about election rigging in 2020. Fox News had paid Dominion $787 million to settle defamation claims. Newsmax paid $67 million. The new company focuses on paper-based ballots, which remain a common vote tallying system in America because auditing is more straightforward.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers what's next in cybersecurity innovation to protect today's digital way of life. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com.
The U.S. has finalized its bailout of Argentina's currency, the peso, a $20 billion swap to help prop up the finances of a country run by a conservative president. The BBC's Ione Wells has that.
Javier Milei has brought down Argentina's previously sky-high inflation and deficit through a program of radical public spending cuts and deregulation. That had pleased the markets, but now things have started to slip. Mr. Milei's party got a trouncing in recent provincial elections ahead of further midterm elections later this month, suggesting some are tiring of his austerity measures. And he's been keeping inflation at bay by propping up the peso and draining reserves at a time when Argentina owes eye-watering debts. The markets have been spooked, fearing that a financial crisis could be imminent and that Mr. Milei is losing political support.
Ione Wells, BBC. And business of sports, the NBA is just now returning to China for the first time since 2019. It's 2 preseason games today and Sunday between the Brooklyn Nets and the Phoenix Suns at an arena in Macau's Venetian Casino and Hotel. NBA China is estimated to be a $5 billion business at this point. The NBA stopped playing in China after the Houston Rockets GM at the time posted a tweet in support of pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. I'm David Brancaccio, Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
More national news is coming up next. This is People Powered KAXE. We keep you posted on important things like weather, on important things like what is happening in your region. For instance, tomorrow, Grand Rapids artist Tom Page is going to be hosting a pop-up show from 2 to 6 at Clacko Brewing. He'll give a brief talk and introduce models from his paintings at 4 o'clock. In Lake George, there is a lutefisk supper tomorrow from 4 to 7:30. They'll also serve lefse, Swedish meatballs, pie, and more. And if that's not enough, in Virginia, it is Fall Flannel Fest. It's at the historic Kalava Hall. Sloppy Joes are going to be served starting at 5, and then there'll be music from the Lindela brothers from 6 to 8. The proceeds benefit the preservation of the Kalava Hall. And Lake Bemidji State Park has a Fall Fest candlelight adventure on Saturday, 6:30 to 8. Take a short candlelit hike to the Lavinia Group Camp for a campfire.